just a big mistake. There's nothing more for anyone to have. Here I am, here you are. Take it.
Good evening, and thanks for joining us. Today on the show, we bring you a follow-up of our G20 coverage. Andrew Longhurst will be interviewing David Mollenhieff, National Chairperson for the Canadian Federation of Students, about their open letter to Prime Minister Harper and Ontario Premier Dalton McGuinty, calling for a public inquiry into the actions and powers of G20 police. Today, we'll also be hearing an in-depth interview with Chief Kim Baird of the Tsawwassen First Nation about National Aboriginal Day and the future development of the Tsawwassen First Nation. We also have our weekly Tai feature, this week with Justin Langille. In this ongoing collaboration, Justin joins us over the phone to chat about some recent stories published on the Tai.ca, the independent daily online magazine. And lastly, we're proud to have this week's arts report from director Adam Janusz filling us in on his upcoming program. That's all today. That's all on today's newscast right here on News 101, your source for community and campus news, and broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia in what is a now sunny Vancouver. But first, here are your headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Nell Abram with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Israel's internal investigation into the Gaza flotilla raid that killed 9 activists is done. While the panel says mistakes were made, it finds that the use of live fire was justified. Rami Almagari reports.
The Turkey Commission says the attack was a result of insufficient intelligence assessment and lack of a preparation for the event. The report does not recommend any legal or disciplinary actions against Israeli soldiers or officers. The 5-member panel further suggests that some aspects of the operation could be praised, particularly the way the Shaitet 13 commanders acted during the operation and the quick evacuation of casualties. The internal investigation, however, was limited in scope as the commission had no power to subpoena witnesses. But today, Israel's High Court of Justice said it will hear a challenge to that narrow scope filed by Gosh Shalom, an Israeli PC group. An expanded mandate could allow the commission to question the military architects of the raid. On May 31, Israel faced a storm of worldwide criticism after Israeli Navy vessels and warplanes forcibly intercepted the maritime aid convoy, carrying more than 600 peace activists from 40 countries and 10,000 tons of aid supplies to the besieged Gaza Strip. Rami Almagari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
Another lawsuit has been filed against Arizona's new immigration law. The League of United Latin American Citizens and the Center for Human Rights and Constitutional Law, both plaintiffs, question state police training materials that call for Arizona law enforcement to consider English language proficiency, clothing, or perceived nervousness to determine reasonable suspicion that an individual is undocumented. A Somali extremist group has claimed responsibility for 2 explosions in Uganda's capital last night. At least 74 people died. Abdul Karim Jamali reports.
The blasts in Kampala struck at a rugby club and a restaurant where crowds of people were watching the World Cup final. A spokesperson for Al-Shabaab, the Al-Qaeda-linked Somali militia, held a press conference today in Mogadishu and claimed responsibility for the blasts. Ugandan government spokesperson Fred Obolot spoke to the media in Kampala. He referred to signs that support Al-Shabaab's claim.
Certainly, there are hallmarks. Two people have been suspected as suicide bombers. But again, we cannot expound that.
Earlier this month, Al-Shabaab leader Ahmed Abdi Godane threatened attacks against the people of Uganda and Burundi because their troops are among the African Union peacekeeping forces in Somalia. Abdul Karim Jamale, FSRN.
A 10-day strike by banana workers in Panama is over, but not before 2 people died and another 120 were hurt. The government agreed to delay a controversial law that would have restricted workers' rights to strike and unionize. Some 7,000 banana industry workers and growers took part in the strike. 115 were arrested. As part of the agreement, they will all be released. An Oregon town will pay $19,000 to a man arrested for recording the arrest of his friend on a cell phone. Jess Burns has more.
2 years ago, Haoxing Vong recorded his friend being detained by police in the parking lot of a Beaverton bowling alley. When police realized what he was doing, they arrested him, confiscating his cell phone. Police claim Vong violated an Oregon privacy law that prohibits electronically obtaining any conversation if all participants are not informed of the taping. But it makes an allowance if those involved reasonably should have known the recording was being made. The law only applies to the audio portion. Beaverton says it dropped the charges because the quality of the tape was too poor to matter. Despite the settlement, Beaverton's police chief says, although the chances are low, police do still have the right to arrest people who tape officers in the field. A memo from the city attorney says, in most police-citizen encounters, there is no expectation of privacy. Other cities across the U.S. are struggling with the issue as well, with similar cases this year in Portland, Oregon, Boston, and Leonardtown, Maryland. Jess Burns, FSRN, Eugene.
The leader of Bosnia Serbs said today that the 1995 mass killings of more than 8,000 Muslims at Srebrenica did not qualify as genocide. Milorad Dodik spoke at a commemoration today for the 3,500 Serbs the government says died during the three-year war. Yesterday, tens of thousands marked the anniversary of the massacre and witnessed the burial of hundreds of newly identified victims at the Srebrenica Genocide Memorial. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
And as always, we thank FSRN for making those headlines available to us. And make sure you come back on upcoming this Monday, 1 week from now, for another edition of headlines from FSRN. Now, as our regular listeners will note, this is the time where we usually jump to Colleen Kimmett, who is our usual guest from the Tai for our Tai segments. But away on vacation, we are instead delighted to be joined by Justin Langille on the phone. So thanks, first of all, for joining us, Justin.
You're welcome.
Coincidentally, let's actually start off with a look at Colleen Kimmett's article from July 7th. In the story, King of Poop Power, Colleen highlights the struggle and energy of a BC entrepreneur who's turning manure into a natural gas substitute. Can you tell us a little bit about what this means, turning poop into energy?
It's a new sustainable way to harness energy for a lot of high-end users, as the article notes, including companies like Google and Microsoft. So it's a really viable way to take waste from farms that otherwise is going to create methane gas and contribute to global warming, and put it to use for industry.
So to my understanding, what's happening basically is that this farmer or this entrepreneur in BC is collecting all of that manure, all of this waste from other farms around him, and is processing it in a facility. And that the natural gas substitute that he's creating is being sold to, it was Terrasen, is that right?
That's correct.
And then that is going to be available for use for energy consumers in the Lower Mainland. But as Colleen writes, it's a universal truth that shit happens, but not everyone is on board. So can you fill us in on how this is just an interim solution to sustainability, as she writes? And what is the economic feasibility of this strategy?
It's basically, the product is there. It's around, there's so many farms in the Lower Mainland that produce waste, so it's viable. And there's, as he mentions, the main character, Chris Bush, who's the guy spearheading this, there's the financial backing to possibly open another 125 copies of this facility in across Canada. So, the finances are there, the raw material is there, it's just a matter of putting the infrastructure into place. And given that, I think that it's something that other places will want to take on and an option instead of other less sustainable forms of energy.
Well, yes, and I think that Colleen highlights that really well in her article, when she addresses the ways in which this type of energy is actually being purchased. And she makes it clear that, or she speaks to experts who make it clear, I should say, that it's not exactly feasible to be used simply electricity. Is that right? Oh, Justin, have we lost you? All right, so we're just going to take a few seconds so that we can get Justin back on the line. Sorry about that, and we'll be right back in a few seconds. This is News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
I'm troubled by shapeless fears. Who can live in the modern world without catching his share of them? I hope I've landed on my feet this time.
Need a place to rent? Have a place for rent? AMS Rents Line can help. AMS Rents Line is an easy-to-operate, touch-tone, and web-based system that connects thousands of landlords with UBC students looking for off-campus housing. UBC students can search the ads for free or place a two-week posting for $5. To view current listings, visit www.amsrentsline.com.
And Big Pharma have entered into a secret conspiracy in which secret government contracts are sold to Big Pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds, all under the watchful eye of Big Coffee, who is secretly working with other world forces, all in a sinister plot to get alien embryos in our coffee so Big Pharma can sell us alien contraceptive pills. Or, if you'd rather get some rational news, check out Radio Free Thinker, the radio show / podcast that promotes skepticism, critical thinking, and science education. Every Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Welcome back. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting in Vancouver. I'm Brad Pepink, and we were just speaking with Justin Langille of the TAI, but unfortunately we were disconnected from him and we've been unable to get him back on the phone. So if Justin is listening, please do phone our station and we'll try to get you on later in our show. Our phone number is 604-822-2487. Otherwise, we do apologize that we weren't able to cover all the stories from the TAI. I would recommend that you check them out. We were going to talk about some other great stories about what's happening with energy, renewable energy, and the Alberta tar sands, as well as co-op housing. You can check out those articles at thetaie.ca, which is thetyee.ca. And so instead, to shake things up on the show, as we like to do with a live broadcast when things go awry, we're going to turn to our regular segment with CITR's art director Adam Janusz for a preview of this Wednesday edition of the Arts Report.
Hello, this is the Arts Report for News 101. I'm Adam Janusz. On this Wednesday's show, we'll have an interview with the executive director of the Vancouver Fringe Festival. That's David Jordan. And we will talk about how the festival is gearing up and getting ready to go for early September. And we'll also talk about the recent BC arts cuts and how they are affecting the Fringe Festival and how the arts community is going to go on. So here's a piece of that interview. Now, I have to ask you about the arts cuts. Like, you've written in your newsletters that it won't be like a single sort of bomb going off, but rather more like acid rain that sort of will reverberate for a long time. Is that, are you feeling that right now?
Well, I think it's going to be, drawn out because, arts groups are always staffed by optimists, people that will find a way to keep going. And, we'll certainly do that too. But then it just becomes harder and harder to keep doing what you're doing with less. That in some way that's our strength, in some way that's our weakness, right? That we just keep going and doing that, enriching society, even when the politicians aren't recognizing the value of that.
Yeah, you've called them Philistines. What's wrong with the attitude of the people up top?
Well, they're systematically, destructuring the arts funding in the province, so that they've cut massively the BC Arts Council, but also the adding body of Ming, so the money that is collected through gambling, and that's historically funded the arts, and they've completely pulled the rug out on that. So they've gone from being quite a major funder of the arts to not funding the arts in very niche ways. So only funding arts that is, done by children, but not for children, not funding festivals at all unless they are a community-driven festival. And also, defining for anything that has any professional arts content is not community oriented, and which boggles the mind. But you can see there's a real anti art sentiment going on in the current government. It's really saddening.
Mm-hmm. At the recent arts summit, the keynote speaker was saying that because in the actual budgetary terms, the cutting the arts doesn't really affect, or you know, doesn't have much of an impact on the budget one way or the other, and that it's mostly a symbolic thing, a symbolic sort of dare I say FU to the arts. Do you think that's true on the part of the BC Liberals?
It looks like that. I mean, there's no, you know, it's really not going to affect the bottom line in any major way. So one can only assume that the cuts are ideological.
Mm-hmm. And so what's the solution? Is it just to change governments and to get people who aren't Philistines on board who actually respect the arts? Is that...
That's part of it, but you know, we're really looking. You know, it's long haul, so this won't. Mm-hmm. You know, like you know, I said before, it's not going to eradicate arts, but
yeah.
Just sets it. You know, it sets us back. And
to hear the rest of my interview with David Jordan of The Fringe, join us Wednesday on the Arts Report at 5 p.m. here on CITR 101.9 FM and streaming online at CITR.ca. Now back to the news.
Welcome back. As Adam said, we are the news on CITR 101.9 FM, and you're either hearing us live broadcasting from the Student Union Building at 101.9 on the FM dial, or streaming online at CITR.ca. And that was Adam Janusz, the arts director here at CITR for this week's edition of the Arts Report, which is a brief highlight of what's coming up on his show this coming Wednesday. We're now going to turn to reporter and director of the news, Andrew Longhurst, who has a follow-up of what's happening in Toronto with the G20 summit. We turn to Andrew.
Last month's G20 summit in Toronto saw the largest mass arrests in Canadian history. Over 900 people were arrested, and countless allegations of police brutality were made leading up and during the G20 summit. A wide range of civil liberty and labor groups, as well as student organizations, are calling for an investigation into the mass arrests and excessive use of force during this time. Among those groups is the Canadian Federation of Students. Joining us now on the phone is Dave Mollenhife of the CFS to discuss an open letter sent by the CFS to the Canadian and Ontario government, specifically Premier Dalton McGuinty of Ontario and Prime Minister Stephen Harper. And the CFS is calling for an inquiry, a public inquiry, into the actions of Toronto police and other G20 police and security during the G20 protests last month. Dave, thanks so much for being on the line.
A pleasure.
So I want to first start out and ask you to tell me a little bit more about the content of this letter.
Well, the letter is quite lengthy by generally speaking, letters that are sent off to politicians, particularly by our organization, just introducing a concept and making a specific demand here. And that's because of the nature of what we've seen and the outcome of the G20 demonstrations and the mass arrests, mass indiscriminate arrests of passers-by and demonstrators. So the letter outlines the concerns that many of our members had identified, and as well as some of the other rally organizers who we had participated with in planning the G20 demonstration on that day. So specifically addressing the curtailment of civil liberties, the language there outlines our concerns with the police actions, the systematic issues with the integrated security unit, and calling specifically on the Premier and Prime Minister to support, to enact a full public inquiry.
And what would you like to see come out of, if there was to be a public inquiry, what would you like to see investigated in that inquiry?
Well, a lot needs to be put on the record. There has been a number of journalists and individuals making use of social media to share their stories, and there's been some fine work done within the mainstream media picking up some of this, but it needs to be part of the public record, and the specific, the grander systematic issues around how this came to pass, that The police, the integrated security unit, as it's called, the conglomerate of different policing agencies in charge of the so-called security that day, addressing the systematic issues around that, that there are clearly major, major problems in terms of who was giving orders and how laws were being taken into interpretation by the police chief in Toronto. And there's no answers that we're seeing coming from the police chief. There's no answers coming out of government in terms of, we've already heard one major issue, which was that the police had come up with their own interpretation of that Public Works Act, which they invented the 5-meter rule. And I mean, that's just the tip of the iceberg. So we would like to see a broad, full, independent public inquiry so we can have everybody's concerns heard and put that written into the public record.
Well, and Toronto Police Chief Bill Blair has said that he welcomes an investigation, but there also will be an investigation looking into practices, but it will be done by the Toronto Police. Why is that type of investigation inadequate in your mind?
Well, there are a number of organizations, labor, social justice, and the like, have outlined how broad-based the problems seem to have been. And I mean, a police inquiry would be fine if we were dealing with a few bad apples. In this case, that's not at all what we saw on the ground on those days where we had the single largest mass arrests in Canadian history around a single event. So in terms of the ability for the police to seemingly take the law into its own hands and interpret laws in their own way shows a broader concern there, and that's why we're calling for a full independent public inquiry. So a number of witnesses can be brought before a government a body to ask the necessary questions of where things went wrong, and that's simply something that's limited in terms of the scope of what an internal police investigation would allow for.
Are there specific incidents or actions that the CFS was particularly concerned to be seen? Obviously, there was a lot of footage, not necessarily by the mainstream press or even the independent press, but just by people witnessing different things taking place. Are there any images that are still in your head that you don't think you'll forget, or are there similar instances where members of the CFS were really quite alarmed to see stuff taking place?
Well, certainly having witnessed some batoning certainly going on in the early, before any window had been shattered, having witnessed individuals being hit with or struck with riot shields and batons in the early stages, even before the demonstration that was peacefully marching down along College Street was able to return to Queen's Park, and then certainly the designated demonstration area for the day was Queen's Park, which as you and everyone across the country saw, was cleared for reasons that are still beyond at least the public discourse, why that was. And so, I mean, those two things are certainly just the tip of the iceberg, but certainly weigh in my mind.
Now, do you feel that students or just young people in general were targeted specifically in crowds by police?
Well, we saw, and it's already part of what the media has been has done some fine work in demonstrating, was that there seemed to just be the police tactics known as kettling, just encircling people and then mass arresting them. Had seen older individuals pushed around by the police who are clearly not members of the so-called or participating in the so-called Black Bloc tactics. And journalists who, with press credentials around their necks, being put into police vans. But certainly, young people bore the brunt of the police tactics that day, with about 1,100 of whom, you know, close to 1,000 of which were definitely younger people who were targeted by the police. So we saw in some instances just complete arbitrary indiscriminate mass arrests, like we saw at the Novotel Hotel, and as well just anyone and everyone being targeted in other instances, like around Queen's Park. So.
Well, and I want to ask you now, just to speak more about the letter. There are a number of signatories to this letter. How many are there, and can you give us a sense of some of the organizations and groups that have signed on to it?
Sure. Well, we've had a few more sign on since, so we're probably hovering around 25 to 30 signatory organizations to the letter at this point. But to give a smattering of some of those who have signed on, we have the Ad Hoc Coalition for Women's Equality, Canadian Association of University Teachers. On the labor sector, we have Canadian Union of Public Employees, Ontario, as well as the Ontario Federation of Labor, and some other associations like National Association of Women in Law, Democracy Watch, and many others. So the organizations are come out of those who are participating in the demonstrations that day, as well as organizations like Amnesty International who have joined with the Federation or are in parallel and calling for a full independent public inquiry. So those who are on the ground that day, organizations that engage in day-to-day advocacy for social justice and civil liberties, are among those who signed on to the letter.
Okay. And have you received any feedback from student union, from your student union membership across the country in regards to this letter?
We have had, I mean, apart from overwhelming positive support and echoing of the call for the public inquiry, found a number of people turning to us to help spread the message about their individual instances with the police tactics that day. So we've actually had a number of people turn to us and explain their situation, having whether they were participating fully in the rally that day or just happened to have been rubbernecking and subsequently scooped up by the police, have heard a number of concerns from that as well, which was really the basis under which we, you know, undertook the work to put this letter together and add our voice to the collective, the growing collective pressure out there from organizations, labor and social justice, right, calling for this inquiry.
Right. And now, has there been any response either from the PM's office or from Premier Dalton McGuinty's office?
Sadly, no.
And do you expect to receive a response?
Well, I mean, at some point, there is going to have to be an answer to these questions, because as you've seen, there's still a good number of people in the thousands who are out there demonstrating this past weekend in defense of civil liberties, and I don't expect that to go away anytime soon. So at some point, there will have to be an answer.
Okay, and lastly, before we let you go, I want to ask you if you think other student groups and bodies should do something similar, like what the CFS has done in calling for a public inquiry. Excuse me. And I'm wondering specifically in regards to the Canadian Alliance of Student Associations, which UBC's Alma Mater Society is a part of. Do you think this is something that really all student groups and associations should be getting behind?
Well, I mean, to each their own, and certainly the view from the ground was certainly different if you were participating in the rally that day or just happened to be tuning in on the television or radio abroad. So you might have a different perspective there, but certainly taking up the issue of injustices, and in this case, a very clear-cut example of an encroachment of civil liberties, curtailment of civil liberties, and indiscriminate mass arrests. And certainly, we've seen a number of individual students, organizations, get in contact with us and other groups to add their voices to this call. So how that would be done through an alliance structure of student associate or student council or alma mater societies, I guess. I'm not too sure how that would work, but certainly I encourage anyone who is interested in defending civil liberties to add their voices to this call.
Well, Dave, I'll let you go there, but thanks so much for joining us on CITR News, and best of luck with the petition, and, you know, maybe you will receive a response.
I hope so.
Okay, take care now. Bye-bye.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And that was Dave Mollenhief. He is the national chair of the Canadian Federation of Students, and we reached him in Ottawa. And now back to Brad.
Thanks very much to Andrew for that report. And to catch up on all of CITR's G20 coverage, check out our podcasts online at citr.ca. Look under In the Studio and you'll find the news. We're going to take a real quick break, but don't go anywhere. When we come back, we'll have this week's weather report. And trust me, you won't want to miss this. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Bond. James Bond.
Got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?
You talking to me? You talking to me?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, I am.
Plastics.
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Just a sweet transvestite.
Where else can you see Hollywood blockbusters, midnight cult classics, indie films, live music, burlesque, stand-up comedy, poetry slams, and live sporting events all at your local theater? Well, at the Rio Theater, of course, voted number one in East Vancouver, your neighborhood indie theater that promotes all things cool. Don't miss the midnight premiere of the most anticipated film of the summer, Inception, directed by Christopher Nolan, starring Leonardo DiCaprio, July 15th at the Rio Theater, 1660 East Broadway at Commercial. For more information, go to riotheater.ca.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, daily grassroots, global, unembedded, international, independent news hour. And this is CITR 101.9 FM.
CITR 101.9 FM is proud to support the 33rd Annual Vancouver Folk Music Festival from July 16th to 18th at Jericho Beach Park. The festival brings a diverse lineup of artists from over 20 countries. Tickets are available at the festival box office at 438 Richard Street and at the following locations: High Life Records, Little Sisters Bookstore, Neptune Records, Banyan Books, and Zulu Records. Tickets are also available online at thefestival.bc.ca. The 33rd Annual Vancouver Folk Music Festival from July 16th to 18th at Jericho Beach Park.
Amelia's face hides behind the mask, sweating on the TV factory line.
Welcome back to News 101, your source for alternative local, national, and international news on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. I'm Brad Pepink, and I'm joined in studio with Andrew Longhurst and Daniel Casanova. And Daniel Casanova is our great weatherman, and Daniel is hoping that you could fill us in on what we should expect for this coming week.
Well, Andrew, we can expect to see some nice summer weather continuing throughout the week with some occasional cloudy periods. Temperatures will be a bit lower compared to last week, with highs reaching into the low 20s. For tonight, we will have partly cloudy skies with a low of 13 degrees. There's a wind warning in effect for Metro Vancouver, with wind gusts reaching 50 kilometers inland and 70 kilometers per hour near the water. Wind speeds are expected to decrease to 20 kilometers per hour near midnight. For Tuesday, we'll have cloudy periods in the morning and afternoon, and with a high of 22 degrees, low of 14. On Wednesday, it will be sunny with a high of 25, low of 15 degrees. For Thursday, it will also be sunny with a high of 24 degrees and low of 16. For Friday, a mix of sun and clouds, a high of 24, and a low of 15 degrees. On Saturday, there will be a mix of sun and cloud, with a high of 24 and a low of 14 degrees. And for Sunday, we will have a mix of sun and cloud, with a small chance of precipitation, high of 24 degrees, low of 15. Currently, it is 19 degrees and cloudy at YVR. That's your weather this week, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. For News 101, I'm Daniel Casanova.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Daniel, for that. We really do appreciate it. And we will make sure to have you back on our upcoming show, which is 1 week from today on Monday, and make sure that you all tune in so that you can hear what's going on. We're now going to turn to an in-depth interview with Chief Kim Baird of the Tuasin First Nation. News Director Andrew Longhurst spoke with her following National Aboriginal Day about how they celebrate the day, as well as the development and future of Tuasin First Nation. Here's that conversation.
This is Andrew Longhurst for CITR News, and I'm on the line with Chief Kim Baird from the Tuasin First Nation. And Chief Baird, can you provide us some recent history of the First Nation, of Tuasin First Nation?
Well, I guess most recently our treaty came into effect in April of 2009, so we've been on the first year and a bit of implementing our treaty under the BC treaty process.
And can you speak to how that has gone? Maybe just talk about the past year.
Well, leading up to and for the past year, we've been very busy with implementation activities. The first part of it is really trying to ensure that we have the legal capacity in place. We passed 23 laws on effective day, and now we've been trying to. Get some of our institutions up and running, our new governance process as established by our constitution. So it's been very time-consuming and very rewarding, though, but it's been a difficult year because everything's brand new and creating everything is extremely challenging for our government and staff.
And I understand the Tuasin First Nation was involved, had some special National Aboriginal Day programming. Can you describe what events took place on National Aboriginal Day just over a week today?
Yes, we had two events on National Aboriginal Day. The first was holding a legislative session with our new governance structure in the morning, and the Minister of Aboriginal Affairs, George Abbott, came in and addressed our legislature and congratulated us on our first year of implementation, basically. And we had some business to do as a government and managed to accomplish that. And then in the early afternoon, we had a groundbreaking ceremony for our industrial lands, new lands that came under the treaty. And we had received some stimulus funding. We're the only First Nation in all of Canada that received that type of stimulus funding that municipalities have received. So we wanted to make the advancement of the development of those lands a reason for celebration and an opportunity to thank the provincial and federal governments for contributing to the project as well.
Right, and this leads exactly right into my next question. Economic development always tends to be an issue for many First Nations, and it sounds like with this new industrial park, it's something that will, address economic development for Tuasin First Nation. Can you speak to the impact that new development will have?
Well, it's a very challenging issue, especially in an urban context. So from internal perspective, Tuasin First Nation, we're trying to build an economy that will support our community needs, whether it be programming, infrastructure, and the like. We also need to create jobs and other entrepreneurial opportunities by creating an economy. In my view, the success of our individuals will be integral to the success of the community as a whole. So we're trying to combine sort of development of public lands with individual opportunities as well. And this is all geared towards increasing people's income levels and other socioeconomic conditions. So that's our strategy for economic development. And we're fortunate in our treaty that we received lands that are adjacent to our existing reserve and provide some good economic opportunities because we're in a good location. It's not without its controversies within the general public surrounding us, though.
Right. And what are some of those potential opportunities and projects?
Well, our community approved a land use plan about 2 years ago, and they approved some general zoning parameters that include industrial, commercial, and residential developments. So there are potential opportunities in all three of those categories of lands, but the more immediate opportunities are in relation to the industrial lands, probably will be container-related development from the port, but there's also a lot of interest in our commercial lands for retail, shopping, and that sort of thing.
And you spoke about controversy within more of the general public about this development. What's at issue, and why is there controversy over the use of that land for economic development by the Tawasin First Nation?
It's a complicated issue with somewhat of a history. We're in an area where most of the area is developed, so a lot of people in the region are opposed to growth residentially or port expansion or these sorts of things. Everyone's worried about impact on the environment and quality of life. Tawasin has faced a lot of impacts due to public infrastructure for Canada and for BC, whether it be the coal port and container terminal or whether it be the ferry terminal. So we know firsthand what some of the potential brunts of those impacts can be, right? So the public is concerned that we will make land use decisions that will impact on traffic and other things that will generally impact on the quality of life. And Tawasin is trying to look to sustainable development that will actually improve the efficiency of the port terminal and decrease trucks and those sorts of things. So unfortunately, we had a hard time developing our lands prior to the treaty because we couldn't legally access a water supply for economic development purposes. The treaty has settled that and provide us the appropriate jurisdiction like a municipality, but not the same as a municipality. And consequently, we're the first First Nation member of Metro Vancouver and now have legal access to water like any other local government does in Lower Mainland.
Right. And so the Tawasin First Nation is the second First Nation with a modern treaty and the first in an urban setting. Can you talk more about what this actually means for governance and how the First Nation will govern itself and just the model that's being used? And just speak to that, those processes as well.
Sure. I think with us being the only modern treaty in BC in an urban setting, the impact is primarily governance and intergovernmental. It isn't that critical an issue, I don't think, in more rural or remote areas, but we're in the middle of all kinds of jurisdictions here, and from the outset, the treaty had to remove us from the Corporation of Delta, their municipal boundaries, and where that left us jurisdictionally in the province took some years to figure out the best way of being involved, and we decided to take the leap of faith and become the first First Nation member of Metro Vancouver from a regional governance perspective.
Okay.
So that's really changed the our sort of legal framework as participating in some of the regional planning processes that make decisions that will impact us. So the first year I've been attending Metro Vancouver meetings and the like, and it's been quite an educational process to sort out how many decisions that affect the region are made at that level and how First Nations haven't had any involvement in that in the past. So,
And you mentioned that First Nations in more rural settings, this model of self-government or these this type of treaty may not be as appropriate, but does it serve as an example and a model for other First Nations around BC?
Well, I think there's models of internal governance and models of government relations aren't quite the same thing. And
right.
I think it really depends on what First Nation is trying to achieve. I mean, for Tawasin First Nation, we're a fairly small population, about 420, and we had a very ambitious self-governance framework. We have decided to make it transformational, to purge the Indian Act, if you will, from our community. And so far, I think we've been very successful. Considering our capacity, some of our laws are quite basic in nature because we just don't have the capacity to draw full down powers to deliver, you know, full education or children and family services, for example, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we can set out some aspirational goals in our laws about what we want to achieve as a community. We've set out a new governance structure that increases community participation in lawmaking. I think increased participation is good, but the trick for First Nations is trying to manage traditional governance practices in a modern and democratic world. And so we've tried a model, and I don't know if it would fit for everyone, but certainly people can learn from our experience and modify it to see what fits their communities. I'm a huge proponent of self-governance for First Nations. I think that's probably the most important tool First Nations need to overcome poor socioeconomic conditions. So whatever shape that comes in, I would urge other First Nations to consider pursuing that for their communities.
Right. And how would you characterize Tawasin First Nations relationship with the BC government?
Very good. I mean, considering we had no relationship with the provincial government prior to the treaty, I think we have very strong working relationship. That's not to say everything's perfect or we won't have problems, but I think we have a strong enough relationship to at least try and work through some of those problems.
Right, and not all First Nations have had such a strong relationship with the provincial government. What advice would you offer other First Nations in regards to the relationship with the provincial government?
Well, it's challenging. I mean, Tawasin chose a model of reconciliation in a very comprehensive way. You can't get much more comprehensive than a modern treaty. That doesn't fit for everyone, but there are other models of reconciliation out there to try and reconcile unresolved Aboriginal rights and title with the Crowns. I think engaging in those processes provide better opportunity to build relationships. And fundamentally, relationships are based on dialogue, and that dialogue increases further understanding about different parties' objectives. So I think First Nations just need to pursue ways to reconcile their outstanding issues with either level of government. But it seems these days the provincial government is quite flexible in trying to look at a number of models of achieving those goals.
Okay, well, any further comments, Chief Baird?
That was quite a broad range of issues, so I don't know what else I can add.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. I really appreciate it.
No problem.
Okay, well, take care now.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was Chief Kim Baird of the Tawasin First Nation. In late June, Andrew spoke with Fight HST leader and former BC Premier Bill Vanderzaam about the Fight HST campaign. Unfortunately, we were only able to air part of that interview because of our G20 coverage, but we're happy to offer the unaired part on our show today. However, if you want to catch the full interview from beginning to end, please jump online to CITR.ca for that interview in its entirety. However, now we're going to listen to Andrew as Bill and Andrew discuss the possibility of a recall campaign, which could bring an end to the current BC Liberal government.
So you just released this so-called recall hit list, and the Premier and the Finance Minister were not listed. Why is that?
Well, for one thing, it's very difficult in a downtown area to do a recall or an initiative because you're not allowed to go into apartment buildings or into condo projects or into gated communities or anything like that without first getting the written permission of the landowner. And in Vancouver, a lot of the landowners live in faraway places like Asia, so it's been rather difficult in those areas, much easier in the more rural areas. However, we're not ruling out anything, and we can change things. We haven't got the list in stone, so there's changes can be made.
Do you think any of it has to do with the fact that in the finance minister's writing of Vancouver Quilchena and the premier's own writing in Point Grey that there isn't a lot of support for the No HST campaign?
Well, there's lots of support. It's just more difficult to get, much more difficult to get. We'd have to do a house-to-house, and house-to-house might have been doable 25 years ago when people weren't afraid to open their doors. Now it's much more difficult. We have found that already. So we've done street corner campaigning. But yeah, it will be more difficult. People aren't quite so readily wanting to get rid of a finance minister or a premier because that creates a degree of uncertainty. But I think the premier is probably about to resign anyway. I don't think he's going to be there very much longer. And he's got all of his lucrative directorships all lined up, I'm sure.
Well, this leads into my next question. Is the main aim to bring down this government, and how do you feel about seeing an NDP government in power?
Well, I guess perhaps I'm certainly not a supporter of either party, but I don't think it makes a whole lot of difference. We used to accuse the NDP, and rightly so, of perhaps not managing the monies very well for the province, but it's been worse with the Liberals, so what's the difference? Not a great deal of difference. And I think the chips will fall where they may, and that'll be up to the people to decide. I can't decide which way the election will go, and I think the Liberals are probably deciding it for themselves.
Well, and there is a lot of discontent with the current parties. Are we likely to see a new center-right party emerge?
I don't know if it's center-right or center or what the party, and I guess there will be a third party, and that's not a bad deal. Otherwise, we're just moving between the Liberals and the NDP, and that hasn't proven to be that satisfactory either. So whichever way it turns out, I don't mind.
That was Fight HST leader and former BC Premier Bill Vanderzaam about the Fight HST campaign. Again, that was just a snippet from an interview originally recorded a few weeks ago in late June by Andrew Longhurst that we unfortunately had to air short because of our G20 coverage. But again, please check out the unabridged version of that interview online at CITR.ca. And before we sign off for the day, I have a few things that I just want to throw past our listeners. On our upcoming show, which is this Friday, we actually won't be live in studio to bring you what's going on in the world, but we are proud to have our partner reporters from across North America bringing us stories of what's going on in the world. So on our Fridays, we will have a new format where we'll be airing. Half of our show will be an edition of Groundwire, which is produced by the NCRA, which is the National Campus and Community Radio Association. And there, this is a bi-monthly program that focuses on stories collected from the ground around, and it's very user generated, and it's really great. We're really happy to have it on our show, so that will be running on one half of the show, and the other half will be a news segment from our friends at FSRN, which is Free Speech Radio News, and we're really happy to have that coverage because it's a very great international focus that is really well funded and well researched journalism, and we're really happy that they're going to be allowing us to air that on our show. So that's every Friday until the end of summer, when the school season starts back up again in September. We'll be happily joining you again on Mondays and Fridays for one full hour on both Mondays and Fridays for our volunteer produced news coverage. And speaking of which, in the coming weeks, we will be posting job descriptions and job ads about how you can get involved with the show, because we are a volunteer program and we want to get people involved because we are really passionate about what we do here, and we think that the more people that can get involved, the better the show can be. So we want people to help us make it happen. And so if that sounds like something that you'd be interested in, please check in CITR.ca in the coming weeks. We'll have postings for different positions that you could help us out with here at News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. And I'm afraid that marks the end of our show for today on News 101. Today's newscast, as I'm sure you already know, was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to get involved, share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter with your username CITRNews. You can also subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at CITR.ca. For more news, join us Monday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101, and again Friday for that edition of Groundwire and FSRN. I'm Brad Pepink. Andrew Longhurst produced this radio program, and for the entire news team at CITR, thanks so much for listening. Stay tuned for Career Fast Track. And before we leave you off, we're going to play a track for you from the new Broken Social Scene album, which is Forgiveness Rock Record, out on Arts and Crafts. We're going to be playing you track number 2, which is Chase Scene. So that's Broken Social Scene's Forgiveness Rock Record with Chase Scene. And again, thanks so much for listening. Have yourselves a great week.